Is the development of the object concept, a very important achievement of the interpreter of Piaget, one of his big discoveries, probably one of his greatest discoveries, the fact that infants acquire a sophisticated understanding of the nature of the physical world around them. It includes this concept of object permanence, knowing that objects, the world around them, continues to exist, even though you can't perceive it. But it also includes understanding of the properties, physical properties of objects. So we're going to look at some research that talks about today. What are you going to learn today? You're going to learn several new things. Firstly, we're going to look at Piaget's ideas about infants' knowledge of objects. One claim he made was that at birth, and for the first few months, the various perceptual systems, touch, vision, hearing, are all independent. They don't communicate with each other. And that has particular consequences for infants' understanding. Second, he argues that babies have no physical knowledge of properties of objects. They have no object concept initially. This knowledge gradually develops during the first 18 months, 2 years of life. So we're going to look at evidence that supports that, what challenges it. And then we're going to look at new work that really goes beyond Piaget and criticizes these various claims that he's made. We're going to look at evidence that perceptual systems are linked right at birth, and they do communicate with each other. We're going to look at evidence that infants do possess, really on a rudimentary object concept, certain concept of permanence, and they do know about the existence of the hidden parts of objects. Look at one of the classic studies that demonstrates this. However, we're going to see this is an innate ability. It does develop, but it develops far more rapidly than Piaget thought was possible. And finally, we're going to look at a very important piece of research that demonstrates that there is some knowledge which is innate. In this case, an understanding of size constancy. So we'll see how that work can be done and what the results are. It's interesting that a few years ago, the Scottish executive published a document which laid out the national Scottish curriculum for nursery schools. And I pulled out some of the landmark achievements that they want children who complete the nursery to have accomplished. And the reason for doing this is that we can trace the origins of these accomplishments right back into infancy. In fact, there is good evidence that infants have some of these levels of understanding. So, for example, recognizing pattern shapes and colors, well, we've seen evidence of that already. And you know now about the research methods we can use to demonstrate it in infants. Understanding some of the properties of materials, for example, soft and hard, not an achievement of the nursery school years. Very young infants know about these properties. In fact, infants as young as 1 month, 2 months of age, as you will see in a moment when I talk about the interesting subjects. They can understand and use mathematical processes such as matching, sorting, and counting. Well, those processes, certainly not, well, part of sorting, not really present in infancy, but there are some abilities. And in tomorrow's lecture, we'll look at research which argues that the origins of numerosity and arithmetic can be found in infancy. There's been a healthy debate about whether infants can do arithmetic, and they add up and subtract, and I'll comment on that tomorrow. Certainly, toddlers, young nursery school children, should develop increasing control of fine movements of fingers and hands, but we're going to see very clear evidence of this in infancy. Babies get exquisite control over their fingers and hands and become very skillful at manipulating objects in the first year of life. And finally, use everyday technology appropriately. Well, in a couple of lectures' time, I'll give you a demonstration of how infants can use technology appropriately to solve problems, quite complex problems. So all of these abilities are not developing for the first time. They're emerging much, much earlier in infancy. So what about the object concept? Here are Piaget's main claims, the things you need to know about. He argued that the perceptual systems are independent at birth. So vision, hearing, touch don't communicate with each other. He argued that they have no physical knowledge. They don't know about the properties of objects. They don't know what it means to be a solid object, that solid objects can't occupy the space like solid objects. They don't know about gravity. They don't know about liquids. They don't know about squeezing and particles. They have to discover all of this by exploring the world. And he argued that objects are known only in the context of action. By action, he also means perception. It's a sensory motor that he's talking about. They don't have mental representations. They don't know about the continued existence of objects, parts of objects that go out of sight, but are not going to perception. We're going to see evidence that, in fact, that is correct. Now, here's a traditional toy. Classic toy for a baby. Baby rattle. Now, if you take a three-month-old, a two-month-old, the baby of that age cannot reach for a seen object. They're interested, they'll look at it, but they don't have voluntary control over reaching. That emerges a little bit later, around 16, 17 weeks of age. But if you place the object in the baby's hand, he'll grasp it, and he'll wave it around, and he'll take it to his mouth, and he'll chew on it. Now, Piaget argued that until about 4 months of age, in 4 or 6 months, the baby is experiencing this one object in a very peculiar way. In fact, there are three separate objects, three separate perceptions. There's the rattle you can hear, the rattle you can see, and the rattle you can feel, both in your hand and in your mouth. But these perceptual systems don't communicate with each other. So the baby is getting three quite separate experiences. Very strange kind of existence. But gradually, through learning, through experience, through acting on the world, the baby begins to link these perceptual systems. And eventually, between 4 and 6 months, they all get linked up together. They begin to talk to each other. And so the baby has a completely different experience. A six-month-old realizes that this is one object. It's a single object, but it has all these different properties. It has a particular feel, it has a particular appearance, and obviously makes a particular sound. So a big change is taking place, according to Piaget, in the first 6 months of life. Perhaps that's all about. Now, Piaget didn't believe babies start with absolutely no abilities whatsoever. He claimed that there are simple reflex processes, which are innate. And these reflexes, they're quite special. They're not a simple kind of reflex, like, say, the knee jerk, where you tap your knee bounces. That is repetitive, it always gets triggered. You can't control it, it's automatic, and it doesn't change, it doesn't develop. It doesn't go away, it doesn't get modified. It's a fixed form of behavior. The reflexes that babies are born with, that Piaget was very interested in, modify, they change with daily use. And these are three of the several that he studied and commented on. Here's one, cat watching, very frequent activity. Baby, young baby lying in a cot, and a hand comes up, and interestingly, you know, babies often act as though it's some independent object that's kind of wandered into their visual field. They don't appear to have any control over the movements of their hand. Sometimes they can stop it and stare at it. Very interested in looking at their hands and fingers. That's what they're doing there. Now, hand sucking, very frequent activity. In fact, I'm sure you may have seen ultrasound pictures of fetuses who are engaging in hand sucking before they've been born. And so that happens at a very early age. So hands go up to the mouth, the baby is getting this feeling of what its hand is like. And also the grasp, the palmar grasp reflex, where babies, if you place an object, the baby feels contact in an object, and its palm closes its hand, its fingers over the object. In fact, if If the baby is grasping an object and you lift it up, if you stretch the arms, you get a really strong palm of grasp. And there are some delightful pictures. Actually, it's a pediatrician who first demonstrated this. You can take a newborn infant and actually put a rod into its palms, get its grasp, and then lift, and the newborn can suspend itself and hold its own weight. It's a very impressive reflex activity. It's adapted if you're a primate, even a very hairy mother, then you know this is adapted to hanging on to her bird. It's not particularly adapted in human infants. However, we've got these three reflexes. Okay? One of them involving grasping and touch, another involving touch as well, and this one involving vision. Now, again, they argue that these reflexes get triggered by all sorts of experiences. You know, the baby watches a hand, and we're getting a link now between controlling action, movement, and vision. And then the hand wanders towards the mouth, and we get stuffy. And maybe somebody just places an object in the baby's hand, or it's grasped, because it's lying there, it's caught. And the object gets watched and carried to the mouth. So we get all of these reflexes getting triggered in sequences, and gradually they link up together. This is Piaget's idea during the first few months of life. And eventually you get to the point where the baby can be shown an object and will now move its hand, watching from hand to object, to guide it in, grasp the object, take it to its mouth, and we've got a situation where the sound the object makes, its appearance, and its feel are all linked together. Receptor systems get organized in this way. So it's simply through experience and repeated activation of these early reflexes which can change in the way they operate. That's a very clever idea. It's a very ingenious idea. Maybe, you know, you could design a robot to link up its perceptual systems in this way. Maybe it would work. Turns out, however, this is not the way babies are designed. And here is a classic study by two Americans, led by Andy Nelson, in which they adapted the visual recognition memory technique to test for recognition across modalities. And the familiarization, rather than being visual, is tactile. It's done in the mouth. What they did was they used two dummies here, or transatlantic visitors, classify them. So here's a regular dummy, nice smooth one. And here's one they got a company to manufacture for. It's got a box all over it, so it's textured. Okay? Now, the babies are divided into two groups. Half can get a smooth dummy, half get a textured dummy. Dummies held in the baby's mouth for 1 minute. And these are 1 minute old, so they know what a dummy is. They suck gum on it, dig it, and they can't pop it out because the experiment is holding it there. It's then removed, taken away completely. They never get to see it. So all they know about it is what it feels like. Okay? And then, on a little stage, two models are presented side by side, like this. One which is smooth, just this end here, not this handle part, just the business part, and this one here. Now these aren't dummies, they're big, they're about this size, side by side, big large things. And it's a preference test, so the amount of visual attention, the amount of looking at each of the dummies is recorded. And what emerged was a very clear, significant preference for looking longer at the dummy that had been in the baby's mouth. So, the baby had the smooth dummy in the mouth, that was the one they looked at longer. Baby had the bumpy one in its mouth, that was the one they looked at longer. Clear evidence that touch and vision are linked up by 1 month of age, way before babies have had sufficient experience to make these or learn these connections, as Piaget claimed they needed to. So a very elegant, very nice, simple little study, which demonstrates that Piaget, although it's an interesting idea, is wrong. It's not the way of ages organizing the world. Here's one of my time favorite studies by Jackie Gibson, the late Jackie Gibson, and Arlene Walker. I think it's quite an extraordinary study. It's a very, very American kind of flavour to this study, as you will see in a moment. We know American students love gum. It's very clear that infants in America know about the properties of gum from a very early age. These are wonderful things. And just like in the milk salt and water study, these babies were given little objects to feel in their mouth. And the objects were a little rigid plastic cube and a little squeezy plastic cube. It wasn't chewing gum, but it had those properties. They were attached to a nylon thread, securely attached to the experimenter hanging on. In fact, babies often don't swallow objects that they have in their mouth, because they use their mouth as a very deft organ of touch. It's exquisite the way they will gum on objects and get a lot of information about how they feel about the shape and the properties. So that's what they do in this experiment. So they get to chew on these objects for a minute, the rigid cube or the squeezy one. You know, they can bite down on it and release their jaws and feel it expanding and contracting. Then, not having seen these objects, they're taken away, and then you get to see two events on a little puppet theater. They see them one at a time, all of it's randomized, and the amount of looking is recorded. And the events involve a sponge, a hand popping up from behind the screen, holding a sponge like this. Now, one of the events simply involved moving the sponge around like this to capture the baby's attention. Now, what you're seeing here is the movement of a rigid object. Okay, all these little dots here, but the dots aren't moving relative to each other. They're on the surface of an object which is rigid. It's retaining its shape, even though it's moving in three dimensions. That's the first event. Here's the second one, a squeezy event. Okay? So the hand compresses the sponge, the dots come together, and then get released. Now, the visual information specifies completely different properties in the objects. And we're very attuned to picking up on these different properties. What about babies? It turned out that just as in the non-conforming study, infants aged 1 month looked longer at the visual object that matched the object they had in their mouth. So if the baby had the rigid cube in its mouth, it looked longer at the event involving the rigid object. If it had the squeezy, chewy object in its mouth, it looked longer at the squeezy event. Now, I'm sure you'll agree, this is an impressive cross-modal linkage, because these infants are matching general properties of movement, general properties of objects' hardness and softness, of what they need in terms of how the objects can be manipulated, how they move. So, yes, children in nurseries need to learn about properties of objects, hardness and softness, but 1 month-old babies are picking up on these characteristics. They know about them already. And it's very good evidence that the immune system is linked to the haptic transfer at an extremely early age, most likely innate, but certainly too early to have been learned. Just one little comment here. You'll notice that the studies I just described are cross-modal analogues of the visual recognition memory paradigm that I talked about. You familiarize the infant with a stimulus, in this case it's something in the mouth, and then you give a preference test. Which of the two stimuli in the preference test does the baby look at longer? Now, if the infant is habituated, as I pointed out yesterday, if they've had a lot of exposure to the familiarized object, you can get a novelty preference. But in these cross-modal studies, and I've just mentioned two, there are many others, you frequently get a result where the baby looks longer at the familiarized object. The one that was in the mouth. Why do they do that? Well, most likely because the object's in the mouth only for a relatively short time, and we don't know how long that time has to be for the infant to learn all of the information, then it's probably too short, sort of comparable to this period of time, this visual recognition memory test. And the result is the learning is incomplete, and they show a familiarity preference, just as babies do when tested entirely in the visual modality. In addition, if you think about it, this, when the baby's looking at the stimulus, there's something familiar. There's that movement of the squeezy object, which is matching the object they have in their mouth. But it's also very different. It's a visual object. It's something they can see. So it's something familiar mixed up with something new. In other words, they don't know everything about the visual display. So consequently, their experience is rather like these infants here, because learning is incomplete. They show a familiarity preference. The important thing is, it's a significant preference. That tells us they process information, but you can sometimes get familiarity preferences just as you get knowledge preferences. Okay, so perceptual systems, in fact, are linked. And I haven't talked about other research, but you can go to the open text and you can read about other studies which demonstrate that hearing and vision are also linked, but they just turn in the direction of stimuli. And you can detect when an event is in synchrony with the soundtrack that they're hearing. So there's good evidence that all of these perceptual systems are from a very early age. Now, what about understanding that objects have maybe hidden parts and knowing that they continue to exist even though you can't see them? He actually claimed that this was a late accomplishment, developing the permanent object concept. But it turns out that, in fact, this is an accomplishment that emerges much, much earlier. We don't have evidence it's innate, but it's certainly there by 2 months of age. And if you think about the usual visual world, our surroundings, we live in a world of clutter. You rarely see objects in their entirety. I'm standing here looking at you, and you're sitting on chairs, I can't see your legs. I assume you have them, but I can't see them. And that's the nature of the world. We see things only in parts. There are lots of things that are missing. And it's a very important topic for Christmas discussion. Here are the rooms, Bruno's Christmas party. This is a very cluttered scene. You don't see anything in its entirety. But nevertheless, you have no problems in figuring out where all the individuals are, where the objects are, what is the table, here's a bit of there, a bit there, a bit there. Let me just make a point. Let's focus in on Grandpa Room. That's what you're seeing. But we know all of these separate parts belong together, and our Grandpa, and all of these parts here, are the chair he's sitting on. Now, how do we do that? Regularly, routinely, every day, every moment, how do we figure out where the objects are in our surroundings when we can only see bits of them? The parts are included, parts are hidden. We use a lot of information to do that. But what about babies? It's been a question that's been asked repeatedly. And Piaget thought babies had a big problem in figuring out which bits of a scene belong together as one object, which belongs to the background or to other objects. Now this is a question that was considered and partly answered by a very interesting group of psychologists working at the beginning of the last century in Germany, the Gestalt psychologists. I'm sure you've probably heard about them, you will hear about them again in the new midway. The Gestalt psychologists argue that before we can recognize anything, there is a fundamental process that the visual system must carry out. And that process is breaking up the scene, the visual world in front of us, into units that belong together, the various parts that constitute forms, and also those that constitute background. And they pointed out that although you might think in this black and white figure here, that this line, this very definite line, carries strong information about the identity of the object, if you, well, of course, you know, it's flicking between different interpretations, but if you can see the faces, you might think that line clearly tells you that there's a nose, and there's lips, and there's a forehead. The Gestalt psychologist pointed out that a contour like this doesn't have any shape, doesn't convey any information on its own, unless this initial process has taken place. You need to know which parts of the scene belong together, which are the figure, and which are the background. So, when you see the black areas as the figure, figure. The white becomes formless, doesn't have a shape, it's the background. Okay? And then, and only then, does this contour take on a meaning, and you can recognize what it is. But when that basic process decides, oh no, the white area is the figure, then that same line takes on a completely different interpretation. It becomes the outline of the object. So we've got this ambiguous figure here. We don't normally encounter them in the three-dimensional world, but it highlights the existence of this fundamental process where we must link different parts of a scene together and see them as units, and only then can we go on and recognize. And the Gestalt psychologists argue that there are a number of processes operating in the visual system in the brain which help us, which allow us to do this. For example, elements that are similar get grouped together as units. So here we've got a nice regular frame through dots, but as we change some of them to black, immediately we group the blue and the black together and you see them as separate. You would describe this as rows of blue and black dots. I define you to describe it as columns of blue and black dots. Similarity is a very strong organizer of vision. Continuity says, well, here we've got two overlapping lines. Now, there's a nice, elegant, continuous line here, and one here, and so we can pick up on that continuity, and I think most of you would have interpreted that figure as these two shapes, one over the other. It could be something different. It could be a much more abrupt change in these two shapes. That's certainly possible, but the visual system doesn't go for abrupt changes, it looks for nice, smooth continuity, alignment. Proximity as well, elements that are close together get linked together as units. See, in this example, and one of the most important indicators that you've got a unit, the parts that belong together, is common movement, or common fate, as the Gestalt psychologists quickly called it. So here's a nice example. We've got six dots, they're moving, but what you see are two units. One unit moving in one direction, one in the other. You group together the elements that have common movement, the same movement in common. It's a very important source of information about what is linked together as a unit in a visual scene. And it turns out that alignment and movement are powerful stimuli for young infants as well. And this comes from work by a very famous American psychologist, developmental psychologist, Liz Spelke. Disagrees completely with Piaget. It's the exact opposite of Piaget. Where Piaget says, babies are born with no knowledge of the world, no object concept, no ability to form mental representations. Liz Spelke argues, babies are born with some knowledge, not everything. There is a lot of development, a lot of growth, but there is some knowledge that remains as a core, even as adults. So there's something babies know about. She claims that. She claims that infants can form representations, they have a symbolic capacity, and she claims they can represent and know about hidden objects. They do have the beginnings of an object concept. So, what is the evidence? Look at some of the evidence today. Just this one topic, and this is a classic study. Came from Spelke's laboratory. Now, if you look at this display, what you see is the rod moving behind the box. And in fact, in the original study, she used three-dimensional objects. So there's a white box in front of the baby, and a black rod moving to a pro. Now, that stimulus provides very strong information that there is a single rod. There's a hidden part here. You can't see it, but you know it's there. You make an inference that it's there. It's moving behind the box. It could be a trick, I'm a psychologist, it could be a trick, but that is typically how adults perceive the display. Now, look at this display, this is a broken rod. You don't see those parts as linked, okay? You don't actually know what's behind the box. You really don't know much about their appearance of the box. You haven't got much information there. The previous display, you know exactly what that rod looks like, even though there's a bit you can't see. Here, you know these aren't joined, they're separate, but you really don't know what they are. Okay, but it's a very different experience. Okay, now, let's carry out an habituation experiment using the techniques I've talked about in the last couple of lectures. What if we habituate babies to this display? Okay. Infant control procedure, we make sure it learns everything they can learn, lose interest. What have they remembered? What information have they encoded in memory? Now, if you're Piaget, you would say they don't know anything about the hidden part. They're not sensitive to this information. All they will remember is the box, and all they'll remember the rod are these two visible ends. That's all they'll know about. Okay? Because they have no capacity for thinking about the hidden part. That comes later. On the other hand, if you're Mrs. Belkin, you'll say, no, that ability is innate. Infants can form representations, they can pick up on this motion of information, they will know about the hidden part. So Piaget would claim infants, given a preference test, okay, will recognize this broken book display because that matches what they've seen, that's what they've remembered, and consequently they're going to look longer at the single rod because they don't recognize it. They've never seen it in their life. They don't know anything about it. Lisbelki, however, is going to say, infants will recognize the single rod. They can make an inference. They know there's a hidden part. They know about this information. They'll look less at the single rod, and they'll look longer at the broken rod, because that's new. They haven't seen that before. Okay? You follow the logic here. It's a very elegant design. And the answer, the pattern of references, is going to tell us whether Piaget is right or Spelke is right. You can now distinguish between these two theories. And here are the results of the very first study carried out by Phil Kelman, one of our graduate students. And here you can see infants, simple infants exposed to this common motion, single rod moving behind the box, they habituate, and then they're given 1, 2, 3 preference tests, and it's not the first test only to get a significant effect, and a big difference. They're looking longer at one display than the other, and the one they're looking longer at is the broken rod display. This they see as novel, the single rod they are recognizers. Spelt is right, Piaget is wrong. Very, very clear result. We don't get any differences on the next two tests. It's not uncommon. I mean, how many, by that time, the babies have been exposed to both stimuli and now either of them is normal. So there's not a problem there. This result has been replicated in many other studies, so it's a very solid, very clear result. So, the interpretation, thinking back to what I told you about this paradigm, this habituation of preferential looking paradigm, we can interpret this result by showing clearly that infants are recognizing a stimulus which part was hidden. They're making inference about the hidden part. Okay? Now, you're psychologists, and your immediate reaction to a big, big claim like this, Spelke jumping up and criticizing a giant like Piaget, is, okay, what's wrong with it? How could you criticize this result? Where did you go wrong? But I'm only going to be part of the result. Now, why don't we need to think about a low-level explanation? And here's an obvious one. What if babies just like looking at broken rods more than single rods? What if they have a spontaneous preference for looking longer at that than that? So it could be, you know, a nice idea, this, but it just doesn't work. We did test it, and they did. It's been tested for, and it turns out that is not the explanation. Here, for example, if we habituate infants to the broken rod display, which doesn't give them any information that there is a single unit with a hidden part, they can picture it okay, but then when we show them exactly the same stimuli in a preference test, there is no preference for looking at the broken rod compared to the single. No preference whatsoever. We can rule out that simple low-level explanation. Now you might say, well, hang on a minute. You know, you're getting a broken rod, but it's two bits. They're not connected, are they? So why don't we recognize this and look longer at this? Remember what I said. Remember what I showed you in the visual display. The single rod, you've got a lot of information about how what that rod looks like. You know what the length is like. You know it's connected. You know there's a missing bit you can't see. With this broken rod display, you really got to know what the rocks look like. I mean, do they just stop immediately behind the box, or do they extend? Are they long? You don't know. And you can't tell just by looking at the display exactly how they look. So there's not enough perceptual information to discriminate these two, and they show it in their reactions. They look equally. So really elegant set of results here, and convincing evidence that babies can represent hidden missing parts of stimuli, and they can interpret the visual world around them. They're not growing up in this confused chaos that was thought to be the case much earlier. Now they are very rapidly making sense of the visual world. In fact, you can do the same study in a cross-verbal way. You can provide babies with information about a rigid object with two rings, two parts, joined by a single rod, and a flexible object, two rings that are joined by a piece of string. And they can explore these by touch without ever seeing them, and then recognize which one they had in their hand. This is a study that the Spelke pair had with a French psychologist, Arlette Strery, working in Paris. And here's how you do it. We've got these stimuli here, and if you place in the baby's hand, this is a four-month-old, and he's got this sheet that's tied on his chin, sticking out in front of him. He can't see what's in his hands. No visual information whatsoever. Okay? So he's just exploring by touch, and the baby holds on to the two ends, and they move the object around. Get a lot of information about whether this is a rigid object or whether it's flexible, the two parts can move separately. You can get away with it up to about 5.5 months. If you do it for 6-month-old, it gets very, very messy. We've tried it, and they fight, and they shout. They don't quite swear, but they do get very upset. They just rip the sheet away. So, very effective technique for depriving young infants of visual information, letting them explore things by touch. And Strether has done a huge amount of work in this area. So, babies get exposed to a rigid object. There they demonstrate that it's not looking time, it's how long they handle the object until they drop it. And you can see they're getting less and less interested because they drop it sooner and sooner. And then we give them a visual preference test. We show them a rigid object moving in a rigid way and the separate objects, disconnected, what do they call them then? Separated objects moving in a sort of separated way. And you can see, just as in the previous study, when they've been habituated to a rigid object, they show interest, significantly more interest in the separated object. They're recognizing the rigid object visually. So infants can pick up on this information in one perceptual modality and transfer it to another. It's a very impressive finding. Again, they're allowed to explore by hand, by touch, the independent separated objects. We get no preference, exactly as we did before in the visual-only study. Very impressive result. So clearly, this detection of opportunity doesn't just occur in the visual world, it occurs across modalities. We can link together different parts of baby scan, different parts of see, and I think that's one key information. Is this innate? Is it present in newborn babies? Turns out, it isn't. And the evidence comes from a study led by Alan Slater at Exeter, who spelled, he was one of the contributors. And what they did was to test newborn babies on exactly the same stimuli that were used in that previous study by Kelvin and Spelke. So here are the newborn results. They're familiarized with this single rod moving behind the box, and then we've got the test stimuli, the single rod, the broken rod. And these are the percentage looking times, preferences. And you can see, in contrast to older babies, a significant preference for the single rod. So babies, in fact, when they're newborns, are recognizing the broken rods that are seen here. They're behaving just as Piaget would have predicted, and they're looking longer at the single rod. By 4 months, it's flipped over. Now, they recognize the single rod, the hidden part, and they see the broken rod as nothing normal. Very striking developmental change. And we know from were by Scott Johnson, that change is occurring at around 2 months. 2 months is the earliest that we've been able to demonstrate that infants can detect and know there's a hidden part in students. So it looks as though Stealthy got one little story wrong. This is not an innate ability, but it does develop very, very early as 2 months of age, and Yagin clearly has got it wrong as well. So, a very intriguing, important result there. Finally, one other piece of evidence which shows that there are some abilities which are innate. And we can demonstrate, in this case, evidence of size constancy in newborn babies, babies just 2 to 3 days of age. This is, again, is work carried out by Alan Slater, a local maternity ward in Exeter. And here you can see one of Slater's assistants sitting with this newborn baby, holding the baby upright, supporting his head. So he's activated, he's interested, and he's looking at this display here. This is a preference test. And he's got these two cubes. Okay? And you'll notice in this picture, one cube is larger than the other one. Okay? Now, this is how the experiment runs. It's a preferential study. The infants are, first of all, familiarized with either the little cube or the big one. Half get one, half get the other. So, for a bias. Okay? On each trial, the cube is suspended at a distance from the infant. The baby is allowed to look until he looks away, and then the cube is removed, and then it's represented, but at a different distance. The distance is always changing. Okay? So on every trial, when the baby is familiarized, the same cube is presented at a different distance. Now what that means is, if you think about the size of the retinal image, that is obviously changing on every trial. Okay? If Piaget is right, and newborn babies don't see objects at different distances, the same object at different distances, as having the same constant size, that baby will be experiencing a new object, size changing, on every single trial. Okay? Because the distance is changing, a baby who doesn't have size constancy will think it's a different object, not the one on every trial. Alright? On the other hand, the baby who has size constancy will recognize simply the same object at a different distance. Okay, so we familiarize infants with the object, and then we give them a preference test. We present the large cube alongside the small one. Let's say they've been familiarized with the small one. The two cubes are presented at different distances. The small cube is nearer than the large one. So when you calculate their size of the image on the retina, they're exactly the same. Okay? They're just appearance. Now again, if infants don't have size constancy on the preference test, they won't recognize either of these cubes. Both of them will be seen as normal. And so they'll show no preference. They'll just look one versus the other. Certainly, retinal size won't direct them to look longer at one than the other because they're different. Sorry, they're different distances and their retinal image is the same size. What do the results come out like? The results show, in fact, babies have size constancy and they look longer at the cube which has a normal size. So if they've been familiarized with the little one, they look longer at the big one. They can detect the change in size and clearly are able to interpret this visual information, not behaving at all as Piaget claimed they should. And this is the strongest, clearest evidence for the existence of size constancy in babies just 2 to 3 days of age. It's clearly an innate ability. So something is innate, and this is why. So, final summary. What I've been talking about is Piaget's ideas on the development of an object concept. He claims conceptual systems are not linked to birth. We've got several pieces of evidence, and there are others you can read in the textbook, which show that they are linked to birth. Babies are transferring information from one system to another. It's something about shape objects, they know something about texture, they know something about their flexible or flexible sleep. We've got good evidence for cross-modal perception now, from both touch to vision to touch, in both directions. Babies don't have to make these connections through experience. They certainly add to it. Don't run away with the idea that newborn babies know everything. They are competent, but they are going to learn a lot through exploring the world. But they don't have to learn many things. We know this lets them study constantly, and we also know that at a very early age, babies know something about the existence of hidden parts of objects. They begin to identify units around them, although we don't have evidence as yet that they can do this from birth. Okay, tomorrow we're going to look at the development of symbolic representation of the baby's reactions to hypnosis. Thank you.